Right, so this is joint work with myself and Kirill Kazanian, who's a postdoc in the University of Leeds. And the motivation for this is to find out and investigate how the zonal flows in Jupiter, which Dave Stevenson talked about and Gary Glatzmeyer mentioned this morning, how do they actually match onto the magnetic interior? We think that Jupiter and Saturn have strong zonal flows, something like 100 meters a second at the near the equator, something like 10 meters a second at the high latitudes, and these comprise strong eastward jets at the equator and alternating westward and eastward bounds at the higher latitudes. Well, the question really is, are some of the jets confined to the stably stratified upper layer? There's a lot of people who believe in the weather layer theory and are looking at GCM models, general circulation models, in order to model this phenomenon. The alternative point of view is that they form Taylor columns and penetrate deep into the interior. Well, if they really are deep and going down into the interior, what happens when these high latitude jets actually meet the Taylor columns, actually meet the dynamo region? So the question is, what happens as you actually get into the magnetic region of the problem? Well, there are probably low core speeds in the magnetic interior. The magnetic field seems to lock the interior, the metallic core together. I should just say this is, Dave Stevenson mentioned this is a metallic hydrogen core in both Jupiter and a smaller one in Saturn. So we've got high conductivity down here, getting quite rapidly low as we move up there into essentially a non-magnetic region near the top. So similarly in Saturn, in this magnetic region, if you do convective velocity estimates of the sort that Ole Christensen mentioned earlier, you come up with numbers of 10 to the minus 3 meters a second, and that's really what you need to drive the dynamo, and is likely to be there. And that, of course, is much, much smaller than these surface zonal flows. So somehow we've got to match these high velocities, called comparatively high zonal flows, that we're seeing near the surface down to these rather low values. And so the question is how that's done. There's further observational evidence that the core is actually rotating reasonably uniformly, because if there were large zonal flows down there, you'd expect to see a large secular variation, which has not been seen between, say, Voyager and Galileo missions. So that's just the banding structure. So there, that sort of brings out what I was saying before. And here we've got the comparatively high radius ratio for Jupiter and the low radius ratio for Saturn. And the zonal flow has this columnar structure. Now, the question arises, of course, when you're thinking about Taylor-Proudman and this kind of thing, as we heard from Matthias Rempel, that latitudinal variations in temperature could drive such a variation in du phi by dz, just as they do in the solar convection zone. The problem here is that as you go deep into the interior, the latitudinal variations actually become rather small compared with what they are at the top. So actually the thermal winds are actually likely to decrease as you go further down rather than increasing. And similarly, the Reynolds stresses tend to be quite strong at the top, and they also decay as you go further in. So there are clearly difficulties in producing something which is going to change u phi as a function of z. Now, this isn't the problem, of course, for the equatorial jets, because the equatorial jets, as you can see, never actually touch the magnetic region, but the high latitude jets actually are. If they're going to have a zonal structure of u phi by dz, they are touch the magnetic interior. So there's a fundamental difference between the high latitudes and the equatorial jet. Well, Boussinesq models do a remarkably good job of solving the reproducing the giant planet zonal flows. I'll just show a picture that's due to Moritz Heimpel and Jonathan Arnaud in the audience and Johannes Vicht. And that's a Boussinesq model. Those colors represent the zonal flows, and you can see the banded structure, you can see the vertical nature of them, and you can see the fast equatorial prograde jet going in the right direction, that's eastward, and the bands alternating there. So it's really quite an impressive result. If you go to this picture here, which is one we've just done from our anelastic model, that's the model that we're now looking at for the benchmark cases, if we go on to the benchmark dynamo, you see jets here. Typically, the velocities at the surface here are somewhat larger, so you get a typically more jagged profile with at a snapshot. If you average this thing over time, you get very similar pictures to that Vicht and Heimpel and Arnault got. So the compressibility is still okay, but it does bring in this big difference that the convective velocities tend to be much larger up here, and the entropy fluctuations are much larger up here, and they're much lower down there, thus the remarks about the Reynolds stresses. I should say straight off that the true Ekman number for Jupiter is probably in the range of at least 10 to the minus 10, probably down to 10 to the minus 12, even if you have some turbulent viscosity. So there's another huge problem here in the sense that our Ekman numbers are much too large. I was sort of sorry to hear that Dave was ashamed of his small Rayleigh number, because I'm rather embarrassed by my big Ekman number. Okay. Right, so all these now the caveat is that all these models use a stress-free boundary condition at the bottom of the layer and no magnetic field in these models. So the issue of how you get from 10 meters a second down to 10 to the minus 3 meters a second is just simply not addressed in either their models or our models. This, I think, was covered actually by Gary earlier, and I'll just go through very quickly this. Liu and Al and Dave Stevenson here is one of the authors in this, pointed out that these large zonal flows can generate quite a lot of ohmic heating, and quite surprisingly, you can actually have more ohmic heating than the flux coming through. But there is an entropy constraint, and we'll just go straight through this because this is essentially what Gary got. I just want a couple of points that Gary didn't mention about this. First is that actually in our simulations, even though we've only got viscous dissipation, it's still actually larger than the flux coming through. So we actually do see this effect in the simulations of getting a larger dissipation than the flux. But nevertheless, the Liu point is still absolutely correct, because even the factor 40 that you can get from this effect still gives you a strong problem with ohmic dissipation. The problem really arises because there's such a huge disparity between 10 meters a second velocities and 10 to the minus 3 meters a second velocities. And when you square that difference, it's a big number. Okay, well, we looked at no-slip boundaries. The simplest, perhaps, model is just to say the magnetic field locks the interior together. And so the simplest model is just perhaps to put a no-slip boundary at the base of the layer. Well, what happens if you do that? In 3D simulations, it just destroys the high-latitude persistent zonal bands, which is slightly sad. It does that both in the Boussinesque and the compressible cases. Actually, I'm not so bothered by that. The actual mechanism by which this happens is that the Ekman boundary layer pumps fluid close to the boundary. It takes out the friction and destroys the zonal flow and returns the zonal flowed fluid back up to the interior. So competing against the Reynolds stress generating zonal flow, you have the Ekman boundary layer pumping, damaging it. But this is actually an order e to the half effect. That's actually quite big in the simulations because my Ekman number is too big, as I said. If you could actually run the simulations at low Ekman number, I think you would find the jets coming back again. But it's difficult to say that in these models, these spherical models, because they're so demanding computationally. But if you look at simple plane layer and annulus type models, you can actually see this effect, where it's actually possible to get down to much lower values of the Ekman number. So just to finish, let's try and now do a little bit of analysis on what actually might be happening as the zonal flow actually meets the magnetic region down below. So this model here is a simple model. It's got the rotation rate in the z-axis and gravity going down, and the magnetic field, I'm assuming, is aligned up in the z-direction. And that's a reasonable thing to do because, as Gary pointed out in his simulations, the magnetic field does tend to be aligned with the z direction and going parallel down to the shear layer. So it is actually as it is in this particular model. And we've got, so I'm going to do a low RM analysis. That's just because it's so much simpler to do the low RM analysis. You can RM with more computing involved, and this is just much neater. Okay, so we're assuming the rotation about the z-axis. The electrical conductivity is a function of depth. So we're going to assume everything's axis symmetric, so that means it's independent of x. And the velocity then has got the zonal component ux, and it's a zonal flow which is varying east and west, so that we make that a function u naught sine ky as z goes to infinity. So as z goes to infinity up here, we go to the surface zonal flow, and down here, we're down in the magnetic region. And so the electrical conductivity is going to zero up here, and it's finite down there. Now, the key equations here are the X momentum equation and the magnetic wind equation. I'll concentrate on the magnetic wind equation first of all. This is sometimes thought of usually in the context of a thermal wind, but here, as we mentioned before, we're ignoring the thermal wind variations. So there's no thermal wind to change our velocity for us, and there's no Reynolds stress here to change our velocity for us, because, as I said, the velocities are quite small down there. So what have we got left with? The only term we've got left with here is this magnetic term here, and this is sometimes known as the magnetic wind equation. So changes in ux with z have got to be produced by these currents. And of course, because they've got to be produced by their currents, those are going to give some ohmic dissipation. And this is the x momentum, which relates the stream function, or that's the actual y component of velocity, with the stresses in the x direction. That's just the shearing stresses from the magnetic field. Together with the induction equation, you get a nice, simple, second order differential equation, sort of things that applied mathematicians like. And the local Lassen number, lambda, turns up where the sigma, which is a function of z, enters in the usual way. So that's a nice, simple second order differential equation. The boundary conditions as jx goes to zero, as z goes to infinity, because the electrical conductivity has got to go to zero. So there are singular solutions and regular solutions of this differential equation, because we're going to make sigma go to zero as z goes to infinity. So we get a nice, neat condition for the top boundary condition. If you integrate the magnetic wind equation, that tells you the current has got to be zero at the top, so that balances that and that. At the bottom, you want the zonal flow to have disappeared, so that gives you a condition on the current in terms of the zonal flow at the top. So it directly relates the current at the bottom to the zonal flow at the top, and that gives you a second boundary condition. So you've got two boundary conditions for a two-point boundary value problem. And the results from the model are that the ux vanishes as you go in. Correctly, it's brought to zero. The x, of course, only exists in the magnetic region. That comes down there. You have to do one other thing, which is to say that the bottom is actually a fixed boundary, so that the fluid has to be returned up. Well, that's, you've got to have something like that, because, of course, you can't keep going inexorably forever. So it's got to turn back. So then you get a UZ, that's the psi, which is an Ekman, which is the sort of equivalent of the Ekman pumping. But instead of having an Ekman layer, this is actually now a variable conductivity layer. And it's got a lot of the structure of an Ekman layer. So that's basically it. So what are the issues that are raised by this model? Well, the ohmic dissipation tends to be large because UX is large. So it's a strong constraint on the dissipation to get that below the entropy limit. So what can we do to actually alleviate this problem? What can we do to make the dissipation as small as possible? Well, there are two things you can do. First of all, you can make the conductivity fall off very rapidly in Z. We heard from Dave Stevenson it falls off very rapidly in Z. Anyway, from the Nellis model, I think it would be even better if it turned out that conductivity fell even faster than the Nellis data actually suggests. So what we'd like is very rapidly falling off in Z. That's good because it makes this whole region thin and therefore reduces the ohmic dissipation. The other thing that would be good is if the magnetic field is strong in the interior of Jupiter. The surface values of the field values give a lambda which is sort of order 1-ish, but if it's down in the interior, B naught might be bigger. That also strongly helps in actually reducing the dissipation because it's basically B times J. J is the problem, so if you make B bigger, you're helping. But there is another problem, which I think Dave has not mentioned, which is the suction, because these flows, this boundary layer here, is actually associated, just as the Ekman layer, with quite a lot of suction. So there's a strong danger that you generate your zonal flows at the top, only have the misfortune that they're all being sucked down into the magnetic interior and have your zonal flow destroyed. So you've got to limit that effect, you've got to limit that the suction. And in fact, suction typically is larger than the Ekman suction because it actually depends essentially on the thickness of the variable conductivity layer, which is actually much thicker than an Ekman layer is likely to be. So again, the way out is basically to have a very sharp transition so that you've got a comparatively thin layer. Okay, so conclusions. Well, the equatorial jets, I think, are not affected by this. The Galileo probe went in. I think probably the deep theory, those probably do go down thousands of kilometers. I think the jury's still out on the high-latitude jets. There's good agreement between the stress-free models in both compressible and Boussinesq. So that argues that the deep jets may be there. But the dissipation entropy constraint strongly constrains these models. So you've got to really have a very sharp layer there over which the electrical conductivity is varying. And the suction arising from these magnetic transition really does need to be included in the global models. Okay, thank you very much.
A couple of comments. First, in respect of the equatorial jet, yes, I think it's fine for the equatorial jet to be on a cylinder, and of course we will find out whether that's actually true with Juno in 2016. However, I did want to make a comment about the definition of the equatorial jet, because for me, it only extends plus minus 16 degrees away from the equator, which is the first zero. And that cylinder actually only gets to 0.95. So there is a little bit of ambiguity in how you define it. And I wanted to make that comment because sometimes people think it goes down to 0.85, but that's because they take it all the way to the first minimum, which is actually at a negative velocity. The other comment, which is really a repeat of something I was saying to Gary this morning, you really shouldn't use that factor of 40. Yes, it's an upper bound, but the Hewitt, Weiss, and McKenzie paper point out that the total dissipation is essentially the luminosity times the number of temperature scale heights. And Jupiter has 5 or 6 temperature scale heights. And you can actually see that from their analysis, and you can also see that by subdividing the total region. The rigorous constraint from which you get that factor of 40 is still correct, but it's an upper bound. The actual number is more like 5 or 6.
Well, I think it does depend on where the dissipation is. I mean, if you look at the entropy equation, it's integral over the local dissipation divided by T, yeah? Now, the local dissipation is made up of magnetic dissipation and viscous dissipation. Now, of course, the viscous dissipation is quite considerable in these models. I mean, it may well be as large as that. And the viscous dissipation certainly is actually primarily up on the top half, because that's where the big velocity is occurring. But, I mean, if you are going to say that the magnetic dissipation is the dominant one, then, I mean, that would be expected to occur primarily at the bottom. So when you look at that integral of Q over T, then that would be dominated by T pretty close to the bottom. So I think in that case, I think you could be nearer 40 rather than the scale height. But
if you want to stick with that number of 40, you have an argument with the authors of that paper. Go back and look at it, because they say that the dissipation is essentially the number of scale heights. I'm not talking about the upper bound.
Okay.
I'm talking about the actual number they get.
But they didn't have magnetic dissipation in, and they certainly
included magnetic dissipation as an example. And you can also, if you want to have a lot of ohmic dissipation in a region where there's not much temperature variation, I want to remind you that the ohmic dissipation is actually only in a scale height or less. If you want to have a lot of ohmic dissipation, you have to import energy in the form of kinetic energy. Now, I'm not saying that's impossible, but I'm just pointing out that's what's required.
That's right.
And then you can get up to 5 or 6, but never 40.
Yeah.
Never 40.
Yeah. Okay. Right.
Any other questions?
Any other questions? Okay, right. Thank you.
Before we all leave, I think this would be a good time for us to again first thank the KITP, David Gross, and Jocelyn in particular, and all the staff here who have really done an excellent job making this a wonderful program.
Yes, Amvar very kindly said last night that it must have been an awful lot of work for us to prepare this program and to run this conference. And my thought on that is, well, yes, it would have been an awful lot of work had it not been for the fact that Jocelyn here did 95% of it, leaving me with rather a small proportion. So I want to thank Jocelyn again personally, as well as all the KITP staff. I think they've done an absolutely wonderful job putting on this program. I think it's been extremely fortunate that we've been here while the boundary layer people and the climate change people have been here, because I think that's added quite a lot of to the whole meeting, and that was entirely them that organized that. It was not us that specially requested that. That was all their idea. That benefited the whole program. But I think the sort of efficiency with which this thing has been run, the sort of smoothness of the organization is really quite unbelievable when you compare it with some of the other things and other places where these sort of things actually happen. So I'd like to thank Jocelyn really very, very much for doing such a splendid job. And as a token of appreciation, we've got a few flowers. Well, I won't load you to them down them all. To share with the rest, yes. And here are a few things. They're mostly bottles. They've been very carefully wrapped. They've been very carefully wrapped by one of the wives of a member. And so you can have a jolly time selecting at random which ones you're going to get. Thank you very much.
I think we should also again thank the four organizers, Ellen Zweibel, Dan Lathrop, Chris Jones, and certainly Steve Tobias, who's kept us on track the entire program.